readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm honored to dedicate this show to our dads. Mark Twain, ever the common sense philosopher, offered up one of my favorite quotes for the day. When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have him around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much he had learned in 7 years. Every year, most of us struggle with finding a gift Dad will actually like. This week, we've simplified the process. I've lined up titles across a broad spectrum. History? Yes, sir. Business? TKO. Sports? We've got some winners. Even dad-centric parenting. And thrillers. My guest today, Jeffrey Deaver, is well known to anyone who's ever walked by a bookstore window. So let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. Let's kick off the Book Report's Father's Day tribute with a gift suggestion for the business-minded dad. The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. An Audio Publishers Award finalist, the book traces the history of the groundbreaking company and its founder. As we all know, Amazon.com started off delivering books through the mail. But Bezos wasn't content with merely being a bookseller. He wanted Amazon to become the everything store, offering limitless selection and seductive convenience at disruptively low prices. To do so, he developed a corporate culture of relentless ambition and secrecy. Author Brad Stone enjoyed unprecedented access to current and former Amazon employees and Bezos family members, serving up an in-depth account of life at Amazon. Compared to tech's other elite innovators, Jobs, Gates, and Zuckerberg, Bezos is a private man. But he stands out for his relentless pursuits of new markets, transforming retail in the same way Henry Ford revolutionized manufacturing. Pete Larkin narrates.
A quantitative hedge fund, DESCO, as its employees affectionately called it, was started in 1988 by David E. Shaw, a former Columbia University computer science professor. Along with the founders of other groundbreaking quant houses of that era, like Renaissance Technologies and Tudor Investment Corporation, Shaw pioneered the use of computers and sophisticated mathematical formulas to exploit anomalous patterns in global financial markets. When the price of a stock in Europe was fractionally higher than the price of the same stock in the United States, for example, the computer jockeys turned Wall Street warriors at DESCO would write software to quickly execute trades and exploit the disparity. The broader financial community knew very little about D.E. Shaw, and its polymath founder wanted to keep it that way. The firm preferred operating far below the radar, deploying private capital from wealthy investors such as billionaire financier Donald Sussman and the Tisch family, and keeping its proprietary trading algorithms out of competitors' hands. Shaw felt strongly that if DESCO was going to be a firm that pioneered new approaches to investing, the only way to maintain its lead was to keep its insights secret and avoid teaching competitors how to think about these new computer-guided frontiers. David Shaw came of age in the dawning era of powerful new supercomputers. He earned a Ph.D. in computer science from Stanford in 1980, and then moved to New York to teach in Columbia's computer science department. Throughout the early 80s, high-tech companies tried to lure him to the private sector. Inventor Danny Hillis, founder of the supercomputer manufacturer Thinking Machines Corporation, and later one of Jeff Bezos' closest friends, almost convinced Shaw to come work for him designing parallel computers. Shaw tentatively accepted the job and then changed his mind, telling Hillis he wanted to do something more lucrative and could always return to the supercomputer field after he got wealthy. Hillis argued that even if Shaw did get rich, which seemed unlikely, he'd never return to computer science. Shaw did after he became a billionaire, and passed on the day-to-day management of D.E. Shaw to others. "I was spectacularly wrong on both counts," Hillis says. Morgan Stanley finally pried Shaw loose from academia in 1986, adding him to a famed group working on statistical arbitrage software for the new wave of automated trading, but Shaw had an urge to set off on his own. He left Morgan Stanley in 1988, and with a $28 million seed investment from investor Donald Sussman, he set up shop over a communist bookstore in Manhattan's West Village. By design, D.E. Shaw would be a different kind of Wall Street firm. Shaw recruited not financiers, but scientists and mathematicians. Big brains with unusual backgrounds, lofty academic credentials, and more than a touch of social cluelessness. Bob Gelfond, who joined Desco after the firm moved to a loft on Park Avenue South, says that David wanted to see the power of technology and computers applied to finance in a scientific way, and that he looked up to Goldman Sachs and wanted to build an iconic Wall Street firm. In these ways and many others, David Shaw brought an exacting sensibility to the management of his company. He regularly sent out missives, instructing employees to spell the firm's name in a specific manner, with a space between the D period and the E period. He also mandated that everyone use a canonical description of the company's mission. It was to trade stocks, bonds, futures, options, and various other financial instruments. Precisely in that order.
We've just heard The Everything Store by Brad Stone. A new thriller for Dad is always a surefire hit. The Book Report recently chatted with a superstar of the genre. Readers, I'm thrilled to welcome Jeffrey Deaver back to the show. We've had the privilege of speaking with him several times. Jeffrey's a Book Report favorite. Jeffrey's written more than 30 novels, and his books are read in 150 countries. He's a former journalist, attorney, and folk singer of note. Today we'll be getting the inside story on his newest title, The Skin Collector. The book is a true sequel to his runaway bestseller, The Bone Collector, which, as you know, was a blockbuster film starring Denzel Washington and Angelina Jolie. Welcome, Jeffrey, and thanks for being back with us on The Book Report.
Delighted to be here, as always.
All right. Jeffrey, I need to congratulate you. Within the first two pages of The Skin Collector, you managed somehow to pull readers into the story and make us care about the girl who sadly becomes the skin collector's first victim. The wild ride begins. How do you do that?
It's my job to give readers the most engaging experience they can possibly have. I don't want my book, in fact, I don't want any book to be interesting. I want a book to be compelling. And, you know, part of that is I guess I call it premeditated ability to create conflict on almost every page so that we don't really know what's going to happen. We raise questions continually, we as authors, I mean. And I spend a huge amount of time structuring my stories, organizing them to make sure that element of, unanticipated conflict is going to be present. And that's what I did on really page one of the Skin Collector.
This book's bad guy is a tattoo artist. What intrigued you about tattooing to build a book around it?
I knew when I wrote The Bone Collector that I was going to intentionally leave several plot points open. The Bone Collector came out about 15 years ago. And I wasn't quite sure how I would resolve those plot points. These individuals who escaped at the end of The Bone Collector. Now, the bad guy was caught in that book. That's not really giving anything away. But the other characters disappeared, but they would come back occasionally, sort of teasing the New York City police and teasing the readers as well. And then finally I decided I probably should bring everything together. I wasn't quite sure how to do that. And I was, oddly enough, having lunch with my assistant, and a waitress came up to us, a charming young lady, and she happened to have a very interesting tattoo on her arm. And I thought right there, oh, I've been looking for a sequel to The Bone Collector. Skin Collector, that phrase occurred to me. The villain tattoos messages on his victims. So he doesn't collect the skin in the sense of cutting it off, but he just tattoos a cryptic message that taunts the police. And that's where the book came about. So I guess I will owe the inspiration to the waitress Muse, who was serving us lasagna, I think.
Did you actually speak with a multitude of tattoo artists to get your information?
Sure. It's very important when you're writing a book about a subject you're not familiar with personally to talk to experts, do book research, internet research. And I did talk to a number of both tattoo artists and people who have been inked and learned a great deal about it. You know, and I have to say that my books are thrillers. They're commercial, popular fiction. And yet I do think it's important for authors of that genre to expand the book beyond the crime story itself. And I grew rather interested in the concept of body modification, and largely because Lincoln Rhyme, my hero in The Skin Collector, is a quadriplegic. So his body has sort of been ultimately modified, if you want to look at it that way. And I was really intrigued with the concept of why people modify their bodies, what kind of person will make that commitment, because, yes, it's possible to remove tattoos, but as one of my heroes in the book, a tattoo artist himself who helps the police solve the crimes, says, you know, you really have to stand up to it. You have to experience the pain. You have to make the commitment that this is going to be a permanent change to your body. And I wanted to look at why people do that, why fashions come and go, and yet a tattoo or other piercing or actually scarification, which is another less popular form of body modification, why that remains so popular among the among the world's populations.
Hmm. You know, one thing that was so fascinating about the book was that the book's villain was intricately familiar with the tunnels and the underground of New York City. How did you become familiar with this network?
When I was living in Manhattan, this goes back over 20 years, I was fascinated with the city in all its aspects, including the infrastructure of New York. And the one interesting thing I learned was that because the streets have always been very congested and crowded, whether you're worrying about taxi cabs or traffic or pedestrians or horse-drawn carriages going back to the 19th century, there were a number of underground passageways and tunnels constructed for commercial purposes so that to cart goods to and from warehouses and manufacturing facilities, these tunnels would not require the workers to have to struggle through the crowded streets of New York. Those are primarily in downtown New York, but there are also huge networks of heating grids, steam tunnels, power tunnels, the subways, of course, existing and abandoned. And you can walk for miles under New York City following these tunnels. And I've been in some of them. You used to be able to take a tour. I don't know if you still can. This goes back many years. But I thought the first time I did that, oh, what a place to kill somebody. Of course, I'm speaking of my books. But I thought someday that's going to figure in my stories. And in The Skin Collector, indeed, the villain prowls through these tunnels and finds victims in such innocuous places as their laundry rooms or in parking garages, and my goal being to really terrify my readers, thinking that something terrible could happen if they go down to do their laundry.
Yeah, you certainly did. And speaking of terrifying, you also take on a fringe militia group in the book. Did these groups scare the daylights out of you?
You bet they do. You know, we, and after 9/11 and other incidents of terrorism, tend to focus on radical Islamic fundamentalist terrorist movements. Certainly a threat, we know that. It's a problem throughout the world. But there are far more active domestic terror and militia organizations in America who are equally intent on destroying the political structure of the United States as non-state terrorists who may have more of a religious motive. And these outfits are carefully monitored by the FBI and the police, and nonetheless, they provide a continual source of threat. Look at the Oklahoma City bombing performed by one of these organizations, Timothy McVeigh, who was operating on his own, but had been affiliated with organizations of that sort. And I thought, well, that's another source of evil we have to be aware of in this crazy life of ours.
Yeah. You know, one thing that always interested me as a reader, crime scenes can be so gruesome. Where do you draw the line when writing about them so that you don't turn off readers?
A very good point. My job is to entertain readers. I want people to have a fun, cathartic experience. In my books, the bad guys never get away with anything. They may escape temporarily. You will never see violence against children, never see violence against animals. You'll never see sexual violence. In fact, the crimes largely occur off camera, I would say. We don't see them. We see the aftermath of crime. But I follow Alfred Hitchcock's approach, which was to create suspense and not shock the audience with gore. Gore is easy to do. I think it's also a creative failing. So I'm very careful to step back from a scene that I think would be troubling and also a scene that I think would be, creatively lazy. It's harder to create suspense, but that's what I want to do.
Oh, good point. And are you working on the next in the series or a standalone novel? Do you write more than one book at one time?
I do indeed. And the presently I'm working on the new Catherine Dance book. Now, she's my other character. She's my police officer from California who's a kinesics expert, body language expert. And she will be back in, that's next year, 2015. And then I am outlining the Lincoln Rhyme book for 2016. So I'll be alternating the two of them, but also working on another standalone that will appear at some point in the next couple of years.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for a wonderfully compelling book.
Well, thank you, Elaine. You take care now.
All righty. Bye. And now let's listen to a sampling of The Skin Collector, performed by Eduardo Ballerini.
Chloe stepped behind a shelf containing a huge supply of blouses so ugly even her mother wouldn't wear them. A major order by a buyer who, Chloe believed, had made the purchase because he knew he was going to be fired. Drip. Drip. Squinting. Odd. What was that? In the far wall, an access door was open. The sound of water was coming from there. The door, painted gray like the walls, was about 3 feet by 4. What did it lead to? Was there a sub-basement? She'd never seen the doorway, but then she didn't believe she'd ever glanced at the wall behind the last shelf. There was no reason to. And why was it open? The city was always doing construction work, especially in the older parts, such as here, Soho. But nobody had talked to the clerks, her at least, about a repair beneath the building. Maybe that weird Polish or Romanian or Russian janitor was doing some repairs. But no. Couldn't be. The manager didn't trust him. He didn't have keys to the basement door. Okay. The creep factor was rising. Don't bother figuring it out. Tell Marge about the drip. Tell her about the open doorway. Get Vlad or Mikhail or whoever he is down here and let him earn his salary. Then another scrape. This time it seemed to be a foot shifting on gritty concrete. Damn. That's it. Get out. But before she got out, before she even spun an eighth turn away, he was on her from behind, slamming her head into the wall. He pressed a cloth over her mouth to gag her. She nearly fainted from the shock. A burst of pain blossomed in her neck. Chloe turned fast to face him. God! God! She nearly puked. Seeing the yellowish latex full head mask with slots for eyes and mouth and ears, tight and distorting the flesh underneath, as if his face had melted. He was in workers' coveralls, some logo on them she couldn't read. Crying, shaking her head, She was pleading through the gag, screaming through the gag, which he kept pressed firmly in place with a hand in a glove as tight and sickly yellow as the mask. "Listen to me, please, don't do this. You don't understand. Listen, listen." But the words were just random sounds through the cloth. Thinking, why didn't I chalk the door open? I thought about it, furious with herself. His calm eyes looked her over, but not her breasts or lips or hips or legs. Just the skin of her bare arms, her throat, her neck, where he focused intently on a small blue tattoo of a tulip. "Not bad, not good," he whispered. She was whimpering, shivering, moaning. What do you want?" But why did she even ask? She knew. Of course she knew. And with that thought, Chloe controlled the fear. She tightened her heart. "Okay, asshole, wanna play? You'll pay." She went limp. His eyes, surrounded by yellow latex like sickly skin, seemed confused. The attacker, apparently not expecting her collapse, adjusted his grip to keep her from falling. As soon as she felt his hands slacken, Chloe lunged forward and grabbed the collar of his coveralls. The zipper popped and cloth tore, both the outer garment and whatever was under it. Her grip and the blows aimed at his chest and face were fierce. She pumped her knee upward toward his groin, again and once more. But she didn't connect. Her aim was off. It seemed such an easy target. But she was suddenly uncoordinated, dizzy. He was cutting off her air with the gag. That was it, maybe. Or the aftermath of the shock. "Keep going," she raged. "Don't stop. He's scared. You can see it, damn coward." And tried to hit him again, claw at his flesh. But now she found her energy fading fast.
That was The Skin Collector by Jeffrey Deaver. John Hay is truly one of the most amazing figures in American history. Yet most of us know so little about him. Hay was both witness and author of many significant chapters in American history, from the birth of the Republican Party, the Civil War, and the Spanish-American War, to the prelude of World War I. Much of what we know about Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt comes to us through Hay's observations, made while he was private secretary to one and secretary of state to the other. John Taliaferro's All the Great Prizes will be a welcome addition to the libraries of history-loving dads. Hay's friends were a who's who of the era: Mark Twain, Horace Greeley, Henry Adams, Henry James, and virtually every president, sovereign, author, artist, power broker, and robber baron of the Gilded Age. As an ambassador and statesman, he guided many of the country's major diplomatic initiatives at the turn of the 20th century: the open door with China, the creation of the Panama Canal, the establishment of America as a world leader. Hay's peers esteemed him as a perfectly cut stone and the greatest prime minister this republic has ever known. But for all his poise and polish, he had his secrets. Joe Barrett performs the book.
The White House would never be the same. To those who worked there, it was an ill-kept, inconvenient, and dirty old rickety concern, made even shabbier by the heavy footfalls and hard use of Civil War. But for all its disarray, it had been John Hay's home. For 4 years, he and his fellow private secretary, John George Nicolay, had shared a bedroom across the hall from the president's office, and throughout the war, no one had lived more intimately with the Lincolns. No one had witnessed more closely the toll of work and worry and death of a son and a 750,000 of a nation's sons upon Abraham Lincoln. To be sure, not every day had been dark, and Lincoln's spirit had not always been so somber. On the occasions, spontaneous and evanescent, when Lincoln's native humor had shone forth, it radiated most directly on the two secretaries, Nicolay, an earnest 29, and Hay, a callow 22, when they first accompanied the president from Springfield in 1861. With unconditional devotion and respect, Hay and Nicolay had taken to calling their Zeus-like employer the Tycoon, or the Ancient. But now, in May of 1865, they too were a good deal more ancient, and Lincoln was dead. A month after the assassination, the White House seemed like a corpse itself, laid out in the clothes of a stranger. Of the two secretaries, Hay had been struck more bluntly by the murder. Nicolay was away from Washington on April 14th, when the President and Mrs. Lincoln went to Ford's Theater. Hay had remained at the White House with Robert Lincoln, the President's eldest son. Over the past 5 years, Robert had spent little time with his father, off at boarding school in 1859 as Lincoln prepared to run for the presidency, away at college in 1860 when Lincoln won his party's nomination and then the national election. Gone for nearly the entire Civil War.
That was All the Great Prizes by John Taliaferro. John Feinstein is one of today's most influential sports writers. Here, in Where Nobody Knows Your Name, he puts his major league talent into crafting a fascinating account of baseball's minor leagues. Listeners get inside the gritty, no-frills, high-stakes world of AAA baseball, which serves simultaneously as a launching pad for superstar careers and as a crash-landing pad for stars who have fallen. Feinstein, who performs the book, focuses on eight men, two pitchers, three position players, two managers, and one ump, and delivers riveting tales of those on the cusp of greatness. So here's the pitch. If Dad is a sports fan, he'll enjoy this title. It gets to the heart of human stories in a uniquely compelling way.
Happiness when he returned to Buffalo. John Lindsay, designated hitter. Lindsay is a footnote in baseball history. He had played more minor league games without a major league call-up than any player in history before that unwanted streak came to an end in 2010. Lindsay liked to say he was an accident away from a return to the major leagues. Not rooting for anybody to get hurt, he would say, but people do get hurt. It's just a fact. Mark Lalo, umpire. At 30 years old, Lalo had finally made it to the major league call-up list in 2011, meaning he got to work a handful of games at the big league level and was in line to move up to the majors in the near future. But 2012 was more difficult. There were fewer call-ups, and there were questions about his umpiring future. Introduction. June 2nd, 2012. On a spectacular late spring evening in Allentown, Pennsylvania, a sellout crowd of 10,100 people packed Coca-Cola Park, the 5-year-old stadium that has served as the home for the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs since 2008. Dusk was rapidly approaching. The temperature was 70 degrees with just a hint of breeze. It was a Saturday night, and clearly the ballpark was the place to be in the town of just under 120,000 that was made famous by Billy Joel's 1982 ballad. Sellouts, or near sellouts, have become commonplace since the franchise that once resided in Ottawa as the Lynx moved to Allentown and became the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs. And with the Pawtucket Red Sox in town for a twilight doubleheader, the park was jumping with noise as the second game began. The Iron Pigs had just 30 minutes earlier come from behind for a 5-4 win in Game 1, and Game 2 had also started promisingly for the home team. The Paw Sox had been forced to start Tony Peña Jr., normally a reliever, because the scheduled starter, Ross Ohlendorf, had opted out of his contract a day earlier to sign with the San Diego Padres. Such is life in the minor leagues. Today's starter for Pawtucket could become tomorrow's starter for San Diego, or, just as often, it happened the other way around. Peña had lasted 3 innings. Arnie Baylor, the Pawtucket manager, would have taken Peña out at that point even if he hadn't given up 6 runs. He had thrown 54 pitches, well beyond the number a manager normally wants to see a reliever throw. And so, when the Iron Pigs came to the plate in the bottom of the fourth leading 6-4, Baylor went to his bullpen. In every minor league ballpark, there is no such thing as nothing going on between innings. fans expect entertainment that goes beyond hits, runs, and errors, and they get it. There are all sorts of contests for fans to participate in, and there is always some kind of entertainment going on to distract those in the stands. To put it in perspective, one of the biggest disappointments of the 2012 season in Durham was when George Jetson night was rained out. In Allentown, one of the more popular fan participation contests is called Whack an Intern. And yes, it is family entertainment, not what you might otherwise think. A large box with four holes cut in the top is brought out to the third baseline. Four of the Pigs' summer interns crawl beneath the box. Two fans are selected and handed plastic bats. Each time an intern pops his head out of one of the four holes, the fans attempt to whack him. The fan who connects most is the winner. While almost everyone in the ballpark was paying rapt attention to Whack an Intern, the reliever called into the game by manager Baylor jogged in from the left field bullpen. When the public address announcer introduced him, there wasn't a hint of a reaction from the crowd. The plastic bats ruled at that moment. The relief pitcher was Mark Pryor, who had last pitched in a Major League Baseball game on August 10, 2006. In the almost 6 years since then, he had pitched a total of 48 innings, an average of 8 innings per season, in the minor leagues for three different organizations, San Diego, Texas, and the New York Yankees. He was 31 years old, and there was no way his presence on the mound throwing his warm-up pitches was going to distract anyone from the announcement of who had won Whack an Intern.
That was Where Nobody Knows Your Name by John Feinstein. Ahoy there! For thousands of years, we've set sail for all kinds of reasons. For battle, to seek our fortunes, for the excitement of exploring the unknown, and the escape from the mundane. Even those who've never been to sea remain fascinated by the seafaring life. Now, a new collection, The Best Sailing Stories Ever Told, edited by Stephen Brennan, brings together such diverse authors as Charles Dickens, Jack London, Stephen Crane, Herman Melville, and dozens more. So, if Dad is a sailor or dreams of being one, this could be a great gift. Mark Ashby narrates.
Remember Brendan, later called Saint, born in the land of Munster, hard by the Loch Lane? A holy man of fierce abstinence, known for his great works, and the father of almost 3,000 monks, he lived at Clonfert then, where we knew him at the first and last. Recall the night, just past Compline it was, when the holy abbot Barrand, later called Saint, came out of the darkness into our circle to visit Brendan. And each of them was joyful of the other. And when Brendan began to tell Barrand of the many wonders he had seen voyaging in the sea and visiting in diverse lands, Barrand at once began to sigh, and anon he threw himself prostrate upon the ground and prayed hard, and then began to weep. Now Brendan comforted him the best he could, and lifting him up, said, "Brother Abbot, have you not come to be joyful with us, to speak the word of God and to give us heart? Therefore, for God's love, do not be afraid, but tell us what marvels you have seen in the great ocean that encompasses all the world." So Barrand began to tell Brendan and all the gathered monks of a great wonder. These were his words.
We've just heard The Best Sailing Stories Ever Told, edited by Stephen Brennan. The newest thriller by David Baldacci has been reviewed with kudos that include: the target is Baldacci at his absolute best. The reader gets a nonstop, pulse-pounding ride that keeps you on the edge of your seat into the wee hours of the morning. Okay, that's good enough for the book report to choose this as a top select for thriller-loving dads. The president knows it's a perilous, high-risk assignment. If he gives the order, he has the opportunity to take down a global menace. If the mission fails, he would face certain impeachment, and threats against the nation would multiply. The president turns to the one team that can pull off the impossible, Will Roby and his partner Jessica Riel. Together, Roby and Riel's talents as assassins are unmatched. But there are some in power who don't trust the pair. They doubt their willingness to follow orders, and they'll do anything to see the two assassins succeed, but not survive. Ron McLarty and Orlar Cassidy share the narration.
The nurse probably didn't know why Earl had been sent to prison and probably wouldn't have cared if he did know. Every inmate in this Max prison had done something so appallingly horrific that every guard and worker here was completely desensitized to it. "Now, just settle down, Earl," said the nurse. "It'll only make things worse." Earl calmed, sat back against his pillow, and then eyed the nurse steadily. "Can they be? Worse is what I mean." The nurse shrugged. "Guess anything can be worse, and maybe you should have thought of that before you got to this place." With a burst of energy, Earl said,
"Hey, kid, can you get me a smoke? Just slip it twixt my fingers and light me up. Won't tell nobody you done it. Cross and swear and all that crap, though, I ain't no God-fearing man."
The nurse blanched at the very idea of doing such a thing. Yeah, maybe if it were 1970. You're hooked up to oxygen, for God's sake. It's explosive, Earl, as in boom. Earl grinned, revealing discolored teeth and many gaps in between.
Yeah, I'll take blowing up over being eaten alive from this crap inside me.
Yeah, but the rest of us wouldn't. See, that's most people's problem, only thinking of themselves.
Just one cig, kid. I like the Winstons. You got Winstons? It's my dying wish. Got to abide by it like my last supper. It's the damn law. He rattled his chain. Last smoke. Gotta gimme it.
He rattled his chain louder.
Gimme it.
The nurse said, "You're dying of lung cancer, Earl." "Now, how do you think you got that? Here's a clue. They call them cancer sticks for a damn good reason. Mary and Joseph. With that kind of stupidity, you can thank the good Lord you live long as you have."
"Give me the smoke, you little prick."
The nurse was obviously done dealing with Earl. "Look, I got a lot of patients to take care of. Let's have a quiet day. What do you say, old man? I don't want to have to call a guard. Albert's on ward duty now, and Albert is not known for his TLC. He'll put a baton to your skull, sick and dying or not, and then lie in his report and not one person will dispute it. Dude's scary and he don't give a shit, you know that." Before the nurse turned away, Earl said,
"You know why I'm here?"
The nurse smirked. "Let's see, 'cause you're dying and the state of Alabama won't release someone like you to secure hospice even if you are costing them a ton of money in medical bills?"
"No, not this here hospital ward. I'm talking prison," said Earl, his voice low and throaty. "Give me some more water, will you? I can get me water in this goddamn place, can I?"
The nurse poured a cup and Earl greedily drank it down, wiped his face dry, and said with pent-up energy,
"Got behind bars over 20 years ago. First, just for life in a federal cage. But then they got me on the death penalty thing. Sons of lawyers. And the state done took a hold of my... Feds let them. Just let them. I got rights. Hell, I got nothing if they can do that. See what I'm saying? Just cause I killed her. Had a nice bed in a fed place. Now look at me. Bet I got me the cancer because of this here place. No, I did. In the air. Lucky for me, I never got that age."
He raised his eyebrows and lowered his voice.
"You know they got that kind in here."
"Uh-huh," said the nurse, who was checking the file of another patient on his laptop. It was set on a rolling cart that had locked compartments where meds were kept.
Earl said, "That's 2 decades plus almost 2 years now. Long damn time."
"Yep. You know your math all right, Earl," the nurse said absently.
That was a sampling of The Target by David Baldacci. Go into a bookstore. Head to the parenting section. You'll find shelves and shelves of books filled with tales of moms, their children, their families. But books about dads? Few and far between. Now, in Steve Doocy's Tales from the Dad Side, you'll find a funny, sometimes poignant look at fathers from a masculine perspective. The broadcaster-turned-author has filled his book with stories of what it's like to be a dad, from the child's first day of kindergarten, the awkward sex talk, right up to the day the ever-practical dad tries to pay for college with his bonus miles. As the author sees it, fatherhood is like Wikipedia. Some parts are based in fact, others are just made up along the way. Now Steve, who performs the book, tries to make it all real.
Generally, mothers never make those kind of mistakes because while they're both parents, dads are different from moms. That could be the greatest understatement since Noah turned on the Weather Channel and found out that the next 40 days called for a 20% chance of light rain. Mothers are reassuring comforters and healers who dole out unconditional love, while fathers are the family muscle, the providers, the tire gauge in the pocket practical guys who twice yearly try to be romantic. "Roses on a Tuesday?" Mom observed as Dad walked through the door. "Were you stopped at the light again?" While there is no disputing that 9 months of pregnancy is rough on a woman, she should walk a mile in a father's hush puppies with 30 or 40 pounds of wiggling kid around her neck for the first 5 years of a kid's life. Seeing a father able to stand up straight after a full day of piggyback rides without a trip to the chiropractor would be as remarkable as seeing Mary-Kate Olsen finish an entire Niçoise salad. "Pops, what time's curfew?" Kane asked his father, Adam.
"Be home before CSI Mesopotamia."
"But, Dad..."
"All right, ask your mother."
That was not what the youngster wanted to hear because everybody knew his mother, Eve, wore the fig leaf in that family. History has shown us that ever since the beginning, moms and dads have been different. In reality, new moms are better at parenting than new dads, but there's a reason why. They are programmed to mother. What is playing with a doll, if not mommy practice? In fact, there is a mega mother industrial complex made up of thousands of magazines, books, classes, and TV shows that instruct women on how to raise the perfect child. Once a week, Oprah Winfrey tells us how to do it, despite never having raised a child, unless you count Dr. Phil. Spontaneously, upon umbilical cord snipping, they become lifelong members of a special sorority with every other mom, which explains how my wife was speaking to a total stranger on a buffet line when the woman confessed, "Forget the knee pain, honey. I had an episiotomy with 69 stitches." Vaguely familiar with the procedure, I quietly crossed my legs and politely nodded in horror. So they have a vast mommy wing conspiracy. Meanwhile, across the gender aisle, fathers are usually clueless about what to do with the new baby at home. I considered it a good father-son outing if I didn't accidentally break off an arm, even though he had a spare. This is what happens to an entire species that has no special father TV shows, zero Maxim articles on 9 simple cures for diaper rash, and certainly no practice dad toys. If you think G.I. Joe inculcates a boy how to be a father, you're nuts. G.I. Joe is not something to cuddle. He's not even a toy. G.I. Joe is a molded plastic killing machine, and please let's keep it that way. In grade school, my brothers-in-law were momentarily fascinated by their sister's Betsy Wetsy, to the point that they disemboweled her to see the doll magic that made her piddle. After their fact-finding jackknife surgery, they returned the doll to the crib, where she was still fed her bottle, despite the fact that from that day forward, Betsy Wetsy peed from her armpit. So a man doesn't have much of a foundation in fathering. It's more on-the-job training, and it starts the day he becomes a father, which for me was the greatest day ever. You know those stories about how life changes? Absolutely true. On the birthday of my first child, when I walked out of that hospital, the sky seemed bluer. And food tasted better, and the songs on the radio were happy and apparently written just for me. I had a reason to be on Earth, finally. I was somebody's dad. I would witness my kids' first steps, first haircuts, and the bloody loss of first teeth. I am, however, not Superman. Nobody can be there for everything, which is how I can live with myself for being out on the mower when my son said his first words, which my wife insists were, "Trust fund." Note to self, no more motivational baby books by Donald Trump.
We've just heard Tales from the Dad Side by Steve Doocy. Readers, in researching this show, I came across an anonymous quote that really resonated with me. "I am a princess not because I have a prince, but because my father was a king." Indeed he was. Thanks, Herb, for your guidance, your integrity, and your love. And thanks to all the dads, sons, and daughters who joined us today. If you still haven't come across just the right title for your gifting needs, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Have a wonderful weekend with your family. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.